This is a Building Bridges special for October 2021, produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, with Dr. Gerald Horn, one of the greatest historians of our time, who gives us an unflinching account of jazz as historically intertwined with racism, white supremacy, and corrupt capitalist labor exploitation. I'm really interested in starting our discussion with the quote from Julian Priester, the trombonist, which says, "Once jazz moved from creative music to product, jazz lost its identity. As soon as capitalism enters the equation, there's no caring about the artistic properties that jazz as a music makes available. Capitalism tends to bring out the negative side of the human mind." Well, that seemed to me to be as good a place to start with this theme, jazz and justice. This is unique because it's jazz and justice, racism, and the political economy of the music. And so it contextualizes the reality of the business of jazz, its commodification, and the reality that the heart of capitalism in many ways is white supremacy. And so what that means both for the artist and not separating the artist from the music. So your book is unique in that it really looks holistically at the evolution and the development of jazz and the sacrifices really of the musicians and the hardships within the context of capitalism. So, Gerald Horn, what drove you to this particular subject, and how do you frame what really is the overarching function, notwithstanding the title of Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music? And thank you for spending your time with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I guess what drove me would include a number of factors. Number one, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which has been a headquarters for music of all kinds. You know that Miles Davis was born and raised in that metropolitan area across the Mississippi River in mostly East St. Louis. And my family is a musical family. My younger brother is a well-known jazz guitarist. Well, actually, resides in New York, played with Elvin Jones, the former drummer with Coltrane, played with Chico Hamilton, and also played in Aretha Franklin's last band before she passed away. And so I grew up listening to all kinds of music. And then on our block in North St. Louis was the Bowie family. That is to say, the patriarch of the family and his son, which included Joseph Bowie, a trombonist of some note, who played in bands with my younger brother from the time they were like 11 or 12. And then, of course, the late, great Lester Bowie of the Art Ensemble of Chicago fame, and Byron Bowie, who was my contemporary. And then, in terms of St. Louis as well, there was this blues AM station, KATZ. So I grew up listening to the blues all the time. And as you know, the blues, in some ways, forms the backbone of this music we call jazz, which, by the way, is a music based upon mastery of different instruments, including but not limited to piano, drums, bass, horns, guitar, etc. And oftentimes involves improvisation at a high level of quality. And I should also say that if you grew up in Cincinnati, for example, across the river in Kentucky, you had a sort of wide open cities and towns. That's where the nightlife was. And the same thing was in St. Louis, right across the Mississippi River is in St. Louis. And so, believe it or not, as a teenager, a person like myself across the Mississippi River and listen to music up until 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning. You might recall that that's where Ike and Tina Turner first hit it big, on the east side, or East Boogie, as they call it in St. Louis. And so that's the sort of background that helped to shape my musical taste and my interest in doing this book. And I should also say that as a historian and as an activist, I've had an abiding interest in popular culture. I did a book on boxing. I did two books on Hollywood. So this book, in many ways, was just a logical extension of that interest.
I've always seen the development or the evolution of Black classical music. It's the soul, it's the essence of a particular form of expression of people of African ancestry. And it's been in that soul through the diaspora and through the Middle Passage. So many of the instruments came from Africa, including what we don't think of today or understand, which is used in bluegrass and so many other forms, and that is instruments like the banjo. What does this music mean in terms of the kind of the essence of expression, again, a particular kind of expression? It's a lyrical expression. It's an improvisational expression. But what is jazz for the people of African ancestry?
I probably should begin the way I begin in the book, or at least the first chapter, talking about the origins of this music, which is a contested story. Now, my brothers and sisters from New Orleans would not agree that it's contested. They think that the issue is settled, that this music had its origins in New Orleans, Louisiana, that it's rooted in the fact that, point one, that as early as 1862, the Lincoln government during the U.S. Civil War had seized New Orleans, which was a deadly blow to the pretensions of the so-called Confederate States of America, which is trying to secede from the United States in order to enslave Africans forevermore. With the ending of the Civil War, the U.S. government, as you probably know, even to this very day, the Pentagon probably spends more on bands and music than as much as any force on planet Earth. That bloated, overly inflated Pentagon budget, which is creeping towards $1 trillion a year of our tax money. And so they leave instruments behind, which are then picked up by the newly freed, formerly enslaved Africans. This takes place in the context of another intriguing point. New Orleans had not only a strong musical culture, particularly opera, but on top of that, you have to realize that before Plessy versus Ferguson, as a lawyer, you're familiar with that case in the 1890s, where Homer Plessy, who we would describe as a light-skinned Negro, wants to evade sitting in a Jim Crow car with other Negroes. And in many ways, this is the last gasp of the French and Spanish settler colonialism, which differs from Anglo settler colonialism, because from the founding of New Orleans circa 1718 up through Plessy in the 1890s, you had this group which we would call light-skinned Negroes, but basically they were sort of an in-between group between the Black population and the so-called white population. And they had certain privileges that the darker skin did not have, and many of them were educated in France. Many of them only spoke French, for example. As a matter of fact, some of the recent scholarship suggests that part of their being folded into this larger Black community, where they are today, I should say, involved becoming monolingual in English, like most of their fellow Black Americans. And so when you have a musician like Jelly Roll Martin, who plays a role in my book, who says, Jelly Roll Martin says, I invented jazz. Now, that's oftentimes seen as hyperbole, and I guess you could say it that it is. But if you dig a little deeper, you could interpret what he's saying is that in order to understand the origins of this music, you not only have to understand point number one concerning what I just said about the newly enslaved grabbing up the instruments that the military bands are leaving behind, but you have to understand this, what we would call the light-skinned Negro population and their cultural traditions, which then, of course, feeds into a musician like Jelly Roll Martin, who may not have invented jazz, but certainly was a key pioneer. So also, when you talk about this New Orleans story, you talk about Storyville, which is this red light district, so-called, to use that euphemism, where the owners of these bordellos are hiring black musicians, or what we would call black musicians. And also another footnote in terms of the unique culture of New Orleans is that one of the most significant lynchings in the history of the United States takes place in New Orleans in the 1890s as this music is taking off, but it involves Sicilians. And it's quite a lesson, because what happens, this outrages the Italian government. Apparently they're in the process of sending a flotilla across the ocean to New Orleans, and it illustrates the point that one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why the indigenous population, the Native American population, the black population have been the recipient of so many atrocities is that when we were lynched, there was no nation like Italy intervening or threatening to intervene, which of course then gives rise to the Pan-Africanist idea, gives rise to Garveyism, which arises approximately a little more than a century ago. So in any event, New Orleans, according to this thesis, is the heart of where, it's a crucible where this music was created. And people point to Congo Square in New Orleans because that's where oftentimes the drumming would take place. Keep in mind that in other slave societies, drumming was forbidden. Just like in other slave societies, it was forbidden for the enslaved to have horns because it would be seen as a way to rally. And there's a long-term horn tradition in many African societies. And I would be remiss in talking about the origins of this music, and I mentioned Jelly Roll Martin. Of course, other people would point to Louis Armstrong, who, of course, his roots are in New Orleans. The airport in New Orleans is named after Louis Armstrong, believe it or not. And he is the vocalist and trumpet player. Many people would argue that some of the traditions that he helped to create have in the music have not been surpassed to this day. But what happens around the time of World War One is that the Storyville is shut down, and then you have this is the traditional story at least, and then you have a sort of diaspora from New Orleans, like Armstrong moves north to Chicago, etc. Now that's one theory. Then there's a kind of what I call a candelabra theory, which is that the music arises simultaneously in many different sites, including New Orleans. You'll probably get angry emails from your New Orleans listeners, so they don't like to hear this. But if you look at Memphis, for example, a city also amongst the Mississippi River, or St. Louis, for example, or even, you know, there's some evidence to suggest a kind of jazz erupting in the San Francisco Bay Area, which, of course, did not have a substantial Negro population before 1942. And then, of course, people point to other nodes for this music, which would include Cuba. And, of course, there's a lot of intercourse before 1959 between Cuba and New Orleans, that is to say, before the Cuban Revolution. And there are many noteworthy Cuban musicians. And then, as we know, jazz is an international phenomenon as well. I mean, it's not only that the grandson of Booker T. Washington was a jazz clarinetist who then migrates and expatriates to Brazil, you have Ethiopian jazz, you have Jamaican jazz. Your listeners are probably familiar with the Jamaican pianist Monty Alexander. So I think part of the issue with regard to New Orleans, with all due respect, is that what happens is that the archivists and librarians at Tulane University in New Orleans begin doing oral histories of musicians, some of whom were born in the 1880s or even before. And they begin doing these oral histories early on. Some of them you can find online. And I think that tips the scales, because if you're looking for unfortunately, the librarians and archivists at University of Memphis did not do this kind of work. And so there's no motherlode of oral histories of black Memphis musicians to the extent that there is of black New Orleans musicians or black St. Louis musicians, for example. And so I think that tips the scale and overdetermines this idea of New Orleans being the source, the code, if you will, for this music.
There's a poetry to your chapter titles, which are taken from various musical compositions, albums, or concepts that actually denotes periods of jazz. Of course, we'll get to one of my favorite, which was always the Haitian fight song by bassist Charles Mingus. But before we hit on that period, let's talk about the history of jazz, both the evolving music and the style the music takes, which coincides with various forms of racial exploitation and discrimination, which is experienced habitually and continuously and currently by artists of African ancestry. What does that say about the music, and where does capitalism come into play as it affects both the production of the music, the airing of the music, and what the hell happened with the artists who were involved in this profound and magnificent improvisational form of expression?
Long footnote about the intersection of Native Americans and Black Americans, because it's not just Jimi Hendrix, the well-known guitarist who was African and indigenous ancestry. There were a number of black musicians who were apparently of the same ancestry. I say this apparently because just like I talked a moment or two ago about this in-between group of what we would call light-skinned Negroes who only began being folded into the black community post Plessy versus Ferguson in the 1890s, in the bad old days, or the worst old days, I should say, of Jim Crow, many black people would claim Native American ancestry because they were embarrassed to claim African ancestry. So you have to take that into account. But having said that, I do think in that footnote there's a lot for future scholars to work with in terms of trying to track down the bicultural nature of this music, at least of some of these musicians, I should say. Now, with regard to capitalism, let me first jump ahead by saying that when you gave that quote from Julian Priester, what I was thinking of was the distinction between various kinds of capitalism, because I think what he said was right on with regard to this rapacious U.S. capitalism suffused with slavery. However, if you look at certain other capitalist countries, particularly capitalist countries which have stronger social democratic, socialist, and communist traditions, you'll find that that's one of the reasons why you've had such expatriation of so many black musicians to Europe. It's because oftentimes they find that it's easier to live because there are government subsidies, for example. That's one of the reasons why Dexter Gordon, the lanky saxophonist from Los Angeles, spent so much time in Denmark, for example. Why the man we knew as Kenny Clark, the drummer, spent so much time in France. I believe that Art Farmer, another a horn man, spent time in Vienna. So it's this U.S. capitalism that Mr. Priester, I think, was on the money with regard to, which is not to downplay the kind of exploitation that black American musicians could face in Europe, because there's been a lot of recent scholarship suggesting that there were certain problems that they encountered there. But I think that it would be a mistake to assume that every capitalist country is like the United States of America. I don't think that would be an accurate assessment. Now, with regard to exploitation, of course, it goes back to the bordellos, the rise of forms of this music in Kansas City, particularly in the 1920s and in the 1930s, when Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, were both wide open towns, not unlike East St. Louis or Covington, Kentucky. And this is a time when you have this political machine there that then gives rise to the U.S. president, Harry S. Truman, who becomes president after 1945 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt passes away. And the clubs are basically dominated by organized crime. And there was this movie, I think it's called Kansas City, with Harry Belafonte, and that portrays some of what I'm discussing now. So it's organized crime that basically runs the clubs. And organized crime, they're not necessarily equal opportunity employers. They're not necessarily social democratic employers. But what's interesting, and this is a typical U.S. phenomenon, about what happens simultaneously across the state in St. Louis, when organized crime wants to hire black musicians for the clubs, and the Ku Klux Klan wants them to be excluded. And so there's a literal showdown between the Klan and the mob, organized crime. And perhaps not surprisingly, organized crime wipes the floor with the mob, and then black musicians win the dubious distinction of being able to be exploited in clubs by the mob, as opposed to being excluded from clubs altogether. Those are the sort of mutually distasteful options that we're oftentimes left with. And of course, Chicago, due northeast of St. Louis, also becomes a headquarters for this music. And there, organized crime figures also reign supreme in terms of the clubs. And then, of course, there's the further dilemma that these musicians face when they go on the road. Because oftentimes when they go on the road, there's always a problem in terms of finding a place to eat, finding a place to go to the bathroom, finding a lodging, for example. Then there's the further issue that sometimes they'll play at sites where there's Jim Crow or segregation. There's a rope down the middle of the hall where they're playing, where black people are on one side and those defined as white on the other side. And then some of these musicians being, well, you know, they have a job as a musician. Sometimes they have extra money that then draws the ire of many races who did not like to see these young black men with dollars in their pockets and instruments, saxophones, guitars, etc., particularly suspecting that this may allow them to be attractive to certain Euro-American women, which then can lead to all kinds of mayhem and mutilation, which is not unknown during that time. And so it's a very difficult road, to put it mildly, for these musicians, which then leads to disparate paths. One path is expatriation. I mentioned Dexter Gordon and Kenny Clark, et cetera, but it's a mass phenomenon because these musicians, they have fungible skills. And so by talking about these black musicians, including Buck Clayton in Shanghai, China. Shanghai is a sort of a wide open town at that time. Wide open meaning that you have colonialism of a special type in China, whereas in India, for example, it's British India, whereas Shanghai is divided between different powers, including a rising Japan. And so what happens is you see a migration of black musicians to China. You see a migration of black musicians to the Philippines. In fact, some of the best cover bands, that is to say bands that can duplicate the sound of jazz musicians, rock musicians, whatever kind of musicians, to this very day are based in the Philippines. You have a jazz diaspora as noted to Brazil, to Cuba, to Europe, I mean all over the world, because these mostly black musicians are trying to escape the grim reaper of Jim Crow. And then another path domestically is organized. That is to say, organizing musicians' unions. And there hangs a tale because there are these Jim Crow locals, as they're called, colored musicians' locals. And then there are the, I guess you could say, non-colored musicians' locals. But what happens there is that oftentimes the club owners are more disposed to hiring what I call the non-colored musicians for various reasons, even though they might not be as talented. And then with the rise of the anti-Jim Crow movement, particularly pursuant to the strategies pursued by the NAACP, you have a forced liquidation of the colored musicians' locals, which then means that the black musicians are folded into the larger so-called white locals, which means they're subjected, which means, number one, oftentimes their records are destroyed and their historical memory is punctured with their records being destroyed. But also, then they become subject to oftentimes what could be easily termed the tyranny of these white musicians who still have an in with club owners. But before that happens, I should also mention the role of New York City, because as I'm sure you know, New York was a headquarters for this music. And in some ways, New York was attracting musicians from all over the country, all over the world, and in fact, denuding places like New Orleans and St. Louis of some of their most talented musicians, because oftentimes there were more opportunities in New York. But what happens there is that for the longest time, this music was associated not only with improvisation, but with dancing. But when it begins to flower in New York, there are those who object to interracial coupling of men and women on the dance floor, particularly black men and Euro-American women. And that leads to certain crackdowns on clubs that allow for such. And then you have this transition. I think that creates favorable conditions, shall we say, for the music then becoming much more of a listening music, much more so than a danceable music.
When you talked about listenable music, one of the deprivations which you point out, et cetera, which was particularly problematic, and yet the music winds up flourishing, that African-American jazz musicians are denied exposure to radio airplay and jukebox access, and they're barred from clubs entirely in many instances, some of which you mentioned, or they're permitted to perform only in segregated conditions. In addition to this, which very often continued having musicians who could not work full-time, and yet it's amazing how they persevered and developed their skills, so that you have folks like Cecil Taylor, right, who was a restaurant worker, and Roy Haynes, who's a whiskey salesman, the great drummer, and the trombonist J.J. Johnson, who works in the post office, and saxophonist Big Nick Nicholas, who works in the post office, and Jimmy Owens, etc., the trumpeter, who's a hospital worker. So the particular deprivations and role of racism as it played out in the ability to be full-time musicians and the ability to have the music heard in the widest array of areas, it's so critical to understand what's happened with jazz today, which I think these are enormously productive and important issues.
Well, I should also add to that litany that you just cited, McCoy Tyner, the late great pianist working as a cab driver. In terms of the difficulties, how Irving Mills, who was the so-called manager of Duke Ellington, the great conductor, pianist, composer with roots in Washington, D.C., how he maneuvers mischievously to place his name, Irving Mills' name, on certain Ellington compositions, which means that today, 2021, there are certain tunes created by Ellington, but the Ellington estate would have difficulty in accruing the revenues and the royalties from those compositions, but the estate of Irving Mills would, which shows you the dead hand of white supremacy and Jim Crow, and that old quotation about how the past is not past. It's still operating. It's like the monster in the movie. You drive a stake through its heart, but somehow it arises from the casket. Then there's the related problem when you have these musicians like the late, great drummer, activist, Max Roach, with roots in the Caribbean, the Great Dismal Swamp, the North Carolina and Virginia border, which was the home of many maroon communities that would say black people would escape from the bonds of slavery and establish their own communities. And then, of course, Brooklyn, New York. He and Mingus, who you mentioned with regard to the Haitian fight song, they try to start a record company to try to do an end run around the labels, because a good deal of this book, as you know, deals with how these record labels, including Atlantic Records, which I believe is still with us, which was started by Ahmet Ertegun, a Turkish national whose father was posted to Washington, D.C. as a diplomat, and then because the Turkish embassy was Turkish soil, he began organizing concerts at the Turkish embassy to circumvent the Jim Crow laws, and from there migrated into starting this record company and becomes fabulously wealthy in the process by dint of exploitation of musicians. And part of this is, once again, in terms of cinematic reference, there's an Ahmet Ertegun character in the movie Ray, with Jamie Foxx's Oscar-winning performance. But in any case, Max Roach and Mingus, they try to start this company, but there's a reason why the system is called monopoly capitalism. Monopoly means that a lot of the bases are occupied and that it's difficult to break into that system. Not to mention the fact that if you do try to break into that system, there's always the lurking menace of organized crime, which is not above using roughhouse tactics in order to discourage you and your business. And Then, of course, there's the related problem of the record labels and the club owners, particularly after 1945, one could say consciously and intentionally trying to push drugs, hard drugs, as they're called, onto these musicians to make them more pliable, shall we say, and more susceptible to being exploited. And you can cite chapter and verse with regard to that. And then there's the related issue. When I talk about John Coltrane, the late great saxophonist with roots in both North Carolina and in Philadelphia, and I should also say that Thelonious Monk, who you referenced, also has roots in North Carolina in addition to New York. Some of John Coltrane's contemporaries and successors have suggested that he sometimes would practice 16 hours a day. Now, if you're practicing your craft 16 hours a day, that does not leave much time to attend to the business aspects of your career. And it makes you more susceptible to relying upon those who are, quote, managing, unquote, your career. And if they're like Irving Mills, you're basically putting your future and your present in the hands of a barracuda. So these are some of the multiple problems that these musicians have encountered over the decades.
I just want you to flesh out a bit more when we're going back to the hook that the clubs played and organized crime. What's the correlation between that hook that they grabbed onto with these remarkable musicians and the reality of racism and how that almost became a subset of capital to control and use these musicians? I mean, what caused really organized crime to latch onto the jazz musician? We understand why they may have needed it to have venues to play in and so on, but it would seem quite peculiar that organized crime families themselves would gravitate to that. And then also you raise another point, which is that drugs become currency. So talk more about that phenomena, too, in the remarkable story that you give us about the evolution and development of jazz and justice.
First of all, I'm sure you're familiar with the era known as Prohibition, which takes place approximately 100 years ago, when there is an attempt systematically to outlaw alcohol. As a matter of fact, one of the most significant women's organizations historically in this country was the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU, which campaigned against alcohol because part of the theory of the case was that the husbands, they get their paycheck, they go to the bar, they fritter it away by drinking, then they come home and they're drunk, and then that leads to all manner of abuse, etc. And so when that movement reaches a sort of success with the banning of alcohol, then, of course, that leads, I'm sure you've seen the movies, that drives alcohol underground or drives it into speakeasies, drives it into clubs, and then organized crime, including certain families that become respectable. I'm thinking of the Bronfman family, B-R-O-N-F-M-A-N. Which to this very day is one of the more affluent families in the United States of America, and at one time controlled not only liquor like Seagram's and other well-known brands, but also had a major stake in DuPont, a chemical corporation based in Delaware, major stake in Hollywood Studios, major stake in the music business as well, because what happens is that with the speakeasies and the clubs, just like the bordellos, you're trying to attract people to the club so that they could buy this liquor, just like in Las Vegas, where gambling is at center stage, you oftentimes have singers and musicians, which then attracts people to the casinos so that the people can fritter their money away in the slot machines and at the roulette table. And so therein, you begin to see how organized crime gravitates towards clubs. But also, you should know that organized crime oftentimes gravitates towards cash businesses. And oftentimes, especially then, perhaps even today, these clubs, they throw off a lot of cash. You need cash to enter the club. You need cash to buy drinks. And then when you have cash business, this allows for money laundering. That is to say that if you want to make a deposit in a bank and you have a licit business and an illicit business, you can mix the proceeds from both together and make the sub $10,000 deposit, which presumably will not alert the authorities that you're dealing in large amounts of cash. And so you'll find that organized crime oftentimes is gravitating towards cash businesses. That would include restaurants, for example, where you oftentimes find them as well. So that helps to shed light upon their relationship to the clubs. And then the same thing holds true to a certain extent with so-called illicit drugs, so-called hard drugs, because they also become a site where you can purchase these drugs. And then that gets into the political aspects, the political economy, if you like, because, as you probably know, you had a figure like Charles Lucky Luciano, who at one time was headquartered in New York and then ran afoul of the authorities, was sent back to Italy, where his roots were. But then it was said that he assisted the U.S. authorities somehow, we are told, in terms of defeating Mussolini and the fascists. Then after World War II, there's the rise of the Communist Party. There's the pivotal election in Italy of 1947. And recall that during the Cold War, one of the most influential and powerful Communist parties happened to be in Italy. And it was suggested that Lucky Luciano was very influential in terms of helping to defeat the communists in the 1947 election. And in fact, it's also been suggested that the U.S. authorities helped to mobilize significant numbers in the Italian-American community generally to reach out to their relatives in Italy to vote the way that Washington preferred. And as part of the bargain, this would allow Luciano and his comrades to then be facilitated in terms of smuggling in drugs, particularly because it was thought that the drugs would only be destabilizing to the black community. And then to add another aspect to this, you may know that during the time we're talking about, 1945, 1946, 1947, and thereafter, that the two leading black politicians in New York City were Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the congressman. The state office building on 125th Street is named after him. You see the statue of him rising from the ground, that I assume is still there. And the other,
indeed it is.
And the other leading black politician was Ben Davis, who was the leader of the Communist Party, elected to the New York City Council, replacing Powell after Powell moves into Congress. And so the authorities thought that it might be a neat idea to flood the black community with drugs, that it would be destabilizing. And then the clubs become a venue from which the drugs can be easily disseminated. And then, of course, when you have musicians like Charles Yardbird Parker, with roots in Kansas City, Kansas, in some ways is viewed as the avatar of this new sound, bebop. In some ways, it's a way to do an end run around pale imitators of the music, like the so-called King of Jazz, speaking of Paul Whiteman, interesting name, I should say. So it all sort of fits together like a jigsaw puzzle. Organized crime with Lucky Luciano, Italian communists, black communists, clubs, drugs. It fits together like a jigsaw puzzle. And then, of course, Charles Yardbird Parker is so influential that many musicians feel that one of the reasons he's so good is not because he started the horn at an early age and that he practiced a lot. They thought that maybe it was because of those drugs that he was so good. And then that leads to people imitating him. And the rest is history.
Well, you know, one of the things also that you do in your book, and I'm so grateful for this, is you don't emphasize and deal with almost salaciously the issues that befell individual musicians as though they were their own frailties entirely, but indeed that the issue of drug abuse and the reality of segregation, the reality of racism and racist treatment that very often drove people into exile took its toll, and it might take the form of drugs or alcohol, etc., but that the musicians suffered enormously, that the ball and chain, no matter what their capabilities and even their stature, continued to be the terrors of living in a Jim Crow society and a white supremacist state.
There have been those who suggested that drugs become a kind of self-medication. That is to say, it's a way for these musicians to deal with the injury and pain that you just articulated in terms of a rapacious white supremacy, a cruel exploitation at the point of production of the music, that is to say, at the clubs, in the recording studios, et cetera, which is a whole other story of exploitation. But once again, we're talking about systems. As I was just mentioning a moment ago, in order to understand the drug question, you have to understand something about global politics, and anti-communism, the Cold War, and all the rest. And it becomes marvelous that so many musicians are able to overcome this. And fortunately, many of these musicians are able to overcome. And like Max Roach or John Coltrane with his tune Alabama, which is an homage to the four little girls who were blown up in the Birmingham church in 1963, they're able to make significant contributions to the anti-Jim Crow struggle, for which we should all be grateful, and are able to then create favorable conditions for the rise of a newer generation of musicians who are able to stand on their shoulders, speaking of Esperanza Spalding, Joshua Redman, and Jason Moran, and Robert Glasper. And speaking of Esperanza Spalding, I would be remiss if I did not discuss the unique issues faced by women musicians.
I was hoping you were going to move there, because I have to say that you repeatedly return and deal with the abuses faced by female jazz musicians, female jazz artists. So please, yeah, continue.
Well, of course, there's Mary Lou Williams, who I guess it's fair to say is catapulted to prominence in 1930s Kansas City before spreading her piano talent to a wider audience. What's interesting about the women musicians in particular is the fact that you have these critics. And, of course, there's a lot in this book about the critics, because other than Mary Baraka, former Leroy Jones. And by the way, at the Max Roach Archival Collection at the Library of Congress, there is an unfinished joint biography of Max that Baraka collaborated on that somebody needs to finish. I don't think it would take that much work, and it would be quite a contribution to both musicology and to the struggle. But in any case, let's say some of the critics, for example, they were not only racist, they would also be male chauvinists. There were critics who suggested that women were incapable of handling the bass fiddle, for example, which would come as a shock and surprise to Esperanza Spalding, amongst others. Then oftentimes women musicians faced bias and discrimination and prejudice from those with whom they shared the bandstand, speaking of the fellow musicians, because what happens, as you probably know, is that oftentimes a musician gets a gig. Say Gerald Horn is a guitarist, and he gets a gig at a club uptown in Harlem, and he needs a piano player and a drummer and a bassist. So it's like pick up basketball to a certain extent. And so what happens is that if the woman musician gets the gig and then she calls a male musician to join her on the gig, sometimes there are problems because perhaps the partner of the male musician, the heterosexual partner of the male musician, does not want some woman calling the house. And then on the bandstand, sometimes the women musicians are harassed, not only by their fellow musicians, but by people in the audience. And let's not even talk about being on the road, traveling from gig to gig. And we already made reference to the difficulties of finding a lodging. And then that difficulty is magnified when you're talking about a woman trying to find lodging on the road. And so, once again, given all the obstacles, hurdles, and barriers, it becomes nothing less than astonishing that so many women musicians have been able to excel, including Dorothy Donegan, who has roots in Los Angeles, By Red, with roots in Los Angeles. I mentioned Mary Lou Williams. I mean, there's a whole litany. And fortunately, you've had scholars as well who have devoted their lives to writing about these women musicians and their multiple accomplishments.
The politics. You mentioned Alabama and John Coltrane in response to the bombing of the Birmingham church that killed four little girls. Musicians that were more overtly political, like we opened up by mentioning the Haitian fight song of Mingus. And indeed, there's another kind of politic, and that is the politic even of Mary, I shouldn't say even, but there's a politic involved with Mary Lou Williams, which you point out, which is really holding on to and taking the brunt of the offenses, the kind of treatment of rhythms and so on, which was enormously avant-garde. Talk more about that particular aspect of people who, as jazz musicians, were, and there's an inherent politic to being African-American in a Jim Crow society. So it's there no matter what. Some people become more overtly and face that. And even, I think you point out, people like Louis Armstrong, who became quite well-known and very often people don't think of as is overtly political. And then there's also, and I just want to give you a couple of leads, you take it, but things like Miles Davis, for that matter, in his really groundbreaking album, Kind of Blue, and I should say that the theme song for Building Bridges is actually taken from that, and it's So What? So that whole element of being a person of African ancestry operating again in capitalism, and the politics of the music and these musicians as well, which is something that you raise.
Well, you mentioned Louis Armstrong, and of course, amongst up-and-coming musicians, including Miles Davis, oftentimes they thought that the persona, the affect of Louis Armstrong was not appropriate. They saw Louis Armstrong as skinning and grinning, as they say. And of course, Miles had a much more a militant affect, much more, one might say, progressive aspect. But as I mentioned in the book, during the time when the Voice of America and the U.S. ruling class were trying to recruit jazz musicians to go abroad to present a prettified picture of white supremacy, Jim Crow, and U.S. imperialism by suggesting that only in America, as Don King might say, could you have this group of Africans who became so skilled and talented with regard to these instruments, these musical instruments. And these artists, they toured the world. And, of course, it influenced their art as well because, for example, you might be familiar with some of the music that Duke Ellington did that reflects Isfahan and reflects his tours of Iran. And he's not alone in that regard. But interestingly, Louis Armstrong is abroad when school desegregation battles erupt. And Armstrong takes a very firm position with regard to his solidarity with the struggling black youth and students, which helps to give U.S. imperialism appropriately a black eye with regard to their attempt to exploit and propagandize around these musicians, because part of the new line becomes that jazz is an exemplar of so-called U.S. democracy, where you have these different musicians, some get a chance to stand forth and do a solo, but they're all united with regard to the basic tune, and it becomes like this metaphor, supposedly, for how the United States works, which, of course, is rank propaganda, because, as I point out, some of Mussolini, a man who could be called the founder of fascism, some of his offspring, of course, were jazz musicians, and it would be difficult to point to them as being avatars of democracy or even free thinking, for that matter. But I should also mention that many of these musicians oftentimes had impact overseas beyond, as noted, with learning about different instruments and different musical traditions abroad. And, of course, in that regard, I should mention the late, great multi-instrumentalist Yusef Lateef, with roots in Michigan, who spent considerable time in Nigeria, or the great pianist Randy Weston, built like a power forward in basketball, towering figure literally and figuratively, with roots in Brooklyn and in Panama, who spent a good deal of his life in North Africa and then imbibed the musical traditions of North Africa, and then it's transferred to his piano keyboard. But then you had musicians like the who might be called an avant-garde bassist, speaking of Charlie Hayden. I talk about in the book how he has a gig in in fascist Portugal, that is to say before the Portuguese Revolution of April 1974. And for some reason, he gets the bright idea of breaking into his epical composition, Song for Che, which is an homage to the Cuban/Argentinian revolutionary Che Guevara. and that does not go down very well, put it mildly, amongst the fascist minded in the audience. And he and his band barely escape intact. And then there's the music coming in the other direction. I'm sure that those with gray hair on your heads, in your head, might recall the South African musicians who expatriated to New York during the pre-1994 epic of apartheid. Speaking of the trumpeter and vocalist Hugh Masekela, who in some ways patterned himself after Louis Armstrong in terms of being a trumpeter and a vocalist, not to mention the pianist, once known as Dalla Brand, then known as Abdullah Ibrahim, who in many ways patterned himself after the fellow pianist Duke Ellington.
As we complete this segment of our discussion about the politics, we have to get back or we have to get into looking at the enormous violations of the musicians as composers' copyright and then the theft of their royalties and so on. But I couldn't help to mention Masekela. Wonder what goodness he would think and who in his estate allowed Grazing in the Grass to become the theme song for a progressive insurance company.
I haven't investigated that case. I hope his name is on the composition. That's all I have to say. Otherwise, it would be like Irving Mills and Duke Ellington. But I should also say that Hugh and Abdullah were akin to Max Roach as well, in the sense that they were not only great artists, they made signal contributions to the struggle, not only in terms of their compositions. I mean, check out Hugh's composition, Stimela, S-T-I-M-E-L-A, which starts all out with Hugh's narration of miners during the apartheid years and digging gold from beneath the surface and bringing it up for the enrichment of a handful of vultures in Johannesburg and New York and London. It's almost graphic. It is graphic in terms of its composition. And the music that accompanies it is so heartfelt. And that's not even to mention, and I can attest to this personally, how they donated their talent to raise money for liberation movements. I'm sure you recall all of the fundraising concerts at St. John the Divine Church at 112th in Amsterdam, or Hunter College, and other sites around New York City, where they would donate their artistry, and we would charge for admission, and then the money would go directly into the coffers of liberation movements. And so an entire book, in fact, could be written just detailing their enormous contributions.
And you do point out, which is people like Charlie Parker performed one of the things that particularly interested me at a benefit for Smith Act victim and Harlem hero, who you mentioned earlier, Ben Davis. And of course, there are some of my very favorite pieces, you know, Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, Aminata Maseka, at that time, Abby Lincoln doing the Freedom Now suite, and Art Blakey's the Freedom Rider. And as we've already mentioned, Mingus had so many pieces, one of the most irksome, I assume, to the system, Fable of Phobos, which was the attack on that Arkansas segregationist governor, Orville Phobos. So the music to me is an inherently political music in any event, but then there's these overt manifestations in the face of Jim Crow, and people should not for one moment take for granted that there was enormous sacrifice, additional sacrifice in doing that and using their art, even though many of the musicians by then had reached enormous stature, how easily they can be knocked off that platform. And you also point out, of course, the benefits that were done in the 60s and 70s, which of a number of these artists are around people in the Black Panther Party and Angela Davis and so on. So it's just all of that really is encompassed in this book that contextualizes the development of the music, jazz and justice, racism and the political economy of the music, and puts it in a systemic context. One of the things that we didn't touch on, but you do, is the whole question of who are traditionally abusive, but the particular role of the music companies, record companies and labels, and really how they really ripped off in every sense the musicians and what that meant as part of looking at the issue of racism and the political economy of the music.
With regard to the record companies, fortunately, and once again trying to lay down tracks for others to follow in my footsteps, there are significant records that future scholars could look at. I mean, for example, in Cleveland at the so-called Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they have the archive of Ahmet Ertegun, for example. They have papers not only of Ahmet Ertegun, but Clive Davis, who, as you know, played a pivotal role in Columbia music, which for the longest, Miles Davis and others recorded for Columbia music. And in fact, in those papers, you'll also find correspondence concerning others that people may want to write about, such as Whitney Houston, Aretha Franklin, for example. And then with this brave new world of streaming that we've moved into, although I'm aware of the fact that there's been a kind of recrudescence of the LP and to a certain extent even of compact disc and cassettes, believe it or not. But streaming seems to be the brave new world, and that introduces a new level of accumulation and exploitation, because at times, literally, the musicians who are creating this music, literally, sometimes are receiving pennies. I mean, and of course, the streaming has also come up in the movie business as well. You probably followed what happened with the megastar Scarlett Johansson when she got into a beef with Disney after she thought she had a contract that said she would get X amount of dollars based upon exhibits in the theater, and then they began to stream almost immediately and then tried to cut back on the money that she was to be paid. Now, they settled out of court. I don't know how it was resolved. But obviously what this bespeaks is a need that has been troubling for decades now. That is to say, a need for a strong, militant American Federation of Musicians, which I'm afraid to say, during its worst days, oftentimes was dominated by the same organized crime figures that dominated the clubs. But just as we speak, we've just seen how another formerly mob-dominated entertainment union, speaking of the movie studio workers who may be going on strike sooner rather than later. They took a vote and apparently voted 90% plus to go on strike, which is apparently given news. It's reinvigorated the talks that are taking place between the International Alliance of Stage and Employees, Theater and Stage Employees, IATSE, and the studios, including Amazon and Netflix. And hopefully the studios will be sufficiently attentive to the fact that the workers, camera operators, the hairstylists, the set decorators, are willing to walk, which could shut down this cash cow. And hopefully these movie workers will prove to be an inspiration for their fellow workers in the entertainment business, particularly musicians.
Well, Gerald Horn, the perseverance of the music as expression of people, I wonder if you can talk more about your particular chapter and Miles Davis, who seemed to embody so many of the elements from being brutally beaten as a African-American musician to going through the various having one of the greatest jazz albums ever, so kind of blue, to the kind of transitions, if you will, with, you know, fusion, et cetera. You know, why did you particularly pick for one of your chapters, kind of blue and Miles Davis, to look at the issue of jazz and justice?
Well, for a number of reasons. Like Miles Davis, I grew up in the St. Louis metropolitan area. The St. Louis metropolitan area has produced a number of leading musicians, including, I mentioned the Bowie Brothers, Marvin Horn, Hammett Blewett, Miles, Dewey Davis, etc. Miles, of course, comes from I guess you could call it a middle-class background. His father was a doctor, a medic. From early on, even as a teenager, Miles was talented. He migrates to New York City, falls in with Charles Yardberg Parker. He spends time in France. He shakes a drug habit. He reaches the stratosphere with Kind of Blue, which by some estimates is the most popular jazz album of all time, although it's also illustrative in that some of the musicians who played with him on that particular album received a flat fee for their talents in the three figures, in the hundreds of dollars, for example, even though the album itself obviously has generated a small fortune. And then, of course, Miles has been celebrated. You know, you had Don Cheadle playing him in a movie. You had a documentary film about Miles Davis that's readily available. You've had him written about by his former partner, Cicely Tyson, who's no longer in the land of the living. You have Miles also seeking to extend his talents into other avenues, such as boxing, for example, which he took quite seriously, and also painting, which he took quite seriously. Miles, in some ways, is sort of a paradigmatic figure, given his talent, given his ability to shape the direction of the music in terms of Sketches of Spain, for example. You mentioned Kind of Blue, in terms of Birth of the Cool, in terms of Jack Johnson, Bitches Brew. And, of course, when Miles moved into that latter phase, it upset some of the purists, although Miles felt that as a creative person, not only as a creative person, but in a sense as a business person, that he should try to attract larger audiences. There's a story, I'm not sure if it's an accurate story, but there's a story about how Miles notices the audiences storming auditoriums to see Sly and the Family Stone, which was this popular, I guess you could call it sort of a black rock group of some years ago. And obviously, if you have thousands of people storming an auditorium, the proceeds will be much more significant than what you can get at a club, even at the best of times, even if it's jammed to the gills. And as the story goes, and once again, I'm not sure if it's an apocryphal story, that helps to inspire Miles to move into that electronic phase. But in any event, in his ability to shift gears and to adapt to the times, to move with the times, it's sort of like Picasso, who has different periods and different phases of his artistic career, that Miles in some ways mirrors that kind of creativity, that kind of flexibility. And that kind of creativity and flexibility is something that I would recommend to other creators.
You talk about laying down tracks, and indeed you have, and you have unearthed the truth and changed the narrative, writing into the narrative, which has so been deliberately left out, the reality of race and the conjuncture of race and class within society. And I think this book, for me, in so many ways, is a metaphor for understanding this music and the people who create it within the context of virulently racist, white supremacist society. And as it evolves from settler colonialism through plantation capitalism through today. So while that's not the subject particularly of your book, how do you assess where the music is and the treatment of the musicians within the state of capitalism today? What is your assessment of the takeaway of this book, which, again, for me in so many ways was a metaphor for understanding race through this brilliant music and the triumphant musicians who, regardless of all obstacles, managed to create one of the most magnificent forms of art that is known to humankind?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Plus, a lot of it depends upon your baseline. I mean, that is to say, you know, I start this book in the late 19th century, and even given the multiple problems I've already sketched in terms of oftentimes unions not standing up for their members, the streaming problem with musicians oftentimes not being compensated adequately, the fact that so many of their compositions you can find online for free, which means that the ultimate creator is being exploited shamelessly and shamefully. But given how I start the book in the late 19th century with people just out of slavery, I think it's fair to say that there have been enormous strides. And I would say particularly pre-pandemic, pre-March 2020, with the ability of musicians to travel overseas. For example, I end the book talking about the L.A. Band leader and horn man, Kamasi Washington, and how he's celebrated in Italy, for example. Now, of course, that's nothing new. As noted, I talk quite a bit about the expatriation of these musicians, but pre-March 2020, there was even more of an ability for these musicians to escape the exploitation of the United States. Is not as if, once again, that going abroad was like a Garden of Eden, but some might think it so, considering what they were escaping in the United States of America. And then, of course, I would be remiss if I did not mention that the very unique relationship that these artists and creators have had with Japan, which has embraced this music as warmly as any other country. But even post-March 2020, you had other kinds of innovations. For example, as I mentioned to you, I do these interviews on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, KPFK, and I interviewed the Harlem-based musician, composer, arranger, trombonist, Craig Harris. And he was talking about post-pandemic, there were these collaborations over the internet, which is something new. I mean, you could have a horn man in Harlem, a bassist in Los Angeles, a piano player in Tokyo, a drummer in Nigeria. So it opens up so many new opportunities for trans-border collaboration. And I find that prospect to be quite exciting, as I'm sure many musicians do as well.
Well, this is, I think, just the beginning of continuing to plow through your phenomenal scholarship and clear love and passion that you bring to this subject. And I do want to say that the descendants of enslaved people create this music, which you continuously mention, and others who have reviewed your book, which is embraced by the whole world, still to be treated as second-class citizens, exploited, dehumanized, and subject to premature death. Well, you help us by following the money, the managers, the musicians, and sadly the bodies in so many instances create a really enthralling, as Robin Kelly said, author of Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, you really help us create this enthralling view of jazz history from the underside. And by so doing, you also give us a very personalized understanding for those of us who need to learn more about the nature of the capitalist state and its indefatigable perversions and efforts to really destroy the human spirit, and particularly to exploit people of African ancestry. It's a fabulous, it's an important book. Gerald Horn, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. Is there any final takeaway that I didn't give you a chance to fully explore?
Well, only that, once again, there's much more work to be done in this field. There's a new Duke University Press book out about the musicians in France, for example. You could do a similar book about the musicians in Africa, for example. I already mentioned Randy Weston in North Africa, Youssef Lateef in West Africa. There are all sorts of records that have yet to be exploited. I mentioned the Max Roach unfinished memoir at the Library of Congress, which somebody needs to dig out. So the work lies before us, and I welcome fellow creators to the field.
Oh, thank you, Gerald, so much. You've been listening to a special highlighting passages from Dr. Gerald Horn's book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, with, again, Dr. Gerald Horn. But, oh yes, while Dr. Horn's talk was a truly significant commentary worthy of the profundity and brilliance of Black classical music, you can't rest content until you read Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. For Building Bridges, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.